For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Fred Sale, and this week, we've got some top new titles for the school summer holidays. Kate Wilkinson takes us onto the London Underground and into the magical world of Edie and the Box of Flits. We catch up with J.M. Joseph and his combustible hero, Aidan Sweeney, a.k.a. Fireboy. And Sarah Moore Fitzgerald wonders whether all the money in the world can really buy you happiness. That's all coming up on today's Read On. I still remember my first trip to London as a small boy. We travelled up from Sussex to visit London Zoo, but I was far more fascinated by the underground trains, and even though I must by now have spent tens of thousands of hours in its clattering carriages, that frisson of excitement about the tube has never left me. It's a feeling I share with Kate Wilkinson, whose debut novel for children, Edie and the Box of Flits, is built around the tube network, as she told me when she joined me from her home in London. Kate Wilkinson, welcome to Read On.
Hello, Red. Very nice to be on the show. It's a great show, and I love audiobooks, so I'm especially honoured to be part of this. Thank you.
For anybody who hasn't yet picked up the audiobook of Edie and the Box of Flits, can you give us an introduction?
It's a chapter book for 8 to 11-year-olds, and it's about a girl called Edie Winter, who's 11, and her dad runs the London Transport Lost Property Office, which is loosely based on the Transport for London one that was in Baker Street, as I was very lucky enough to go and visit during my research. Anyway, this character, Edie Winter, she's just started secondary school, and she's going through, I think, what often happens when children leave a relatively small and friendly primary school and move to a big secondary, sometimes with 9 classes of 30 or whatever, as that's what happened to my son anyway. And in the case of Edie, she's not really ready for that, and she still wants to play those kind of playground games. And what she's discovered is that her old primary school friends have slightly dumped her and gone off to be with the popular gang and look at their phones and think about clothes and stuff like that. So the book starts with Edie pretty lonely, really. She spends the first half term with her dad, decides that she's going to help him with work on the Lost Property Office, and they go out and about looking for abandoned and missing items on the London Underground. And on the Piccadilly line, she spots an abandoned box on a seat across the carriage in front of her. And they collect the box and take it back to the Lost Property Office. And as Edie is handing it over to Dad to register it and everything, she feels something fluttering inside. And so begins this adventure, which stretches out over the London Underground to abandoned, wild, derelict wilderness stations, and then ends up with a big denouement, big scene in a ghost station deep underground, because I've always been so interested by those strange secret corners of the London Underground. And the flits of the title, they turn out to be thumb-sized creatures, small people really. Definitely not fairies, Red, I should say that. Definitely not fairies. But they are in trouble, and Edie sets out to help them. And that's really the premise of the book.
And the flits can only be seen by children, not by adults. And as you say, they are in trouble. They need to get home, and one of them is missing.
That's right. One of them is missing. Something strange is going on. Someone is stealing the flits and using them for their own devices, and it turns out that they are in fact being used by the villain of the piece, who's Vera Creech, and she's an employee at the Lost Property Office, and she is stealing these flits because they have such tiny fingers, they're perfect for a huge spate of pickpocketing on the London Underground, stealing valuables of all kinds, which of course has a big impact on the Lost Property Office, because people come to them and they're not finding things which are going missing. So it ends up that Edie and her friends have to find out what's happened to the missing Flits and also where all these valuables are going on the London Underground, why so many passengers are complaining that stuff's going missing and isn't being found. I love the theme of lost and found, because I think also at that age, which Edie is, and that's why I wanted this idea of childhood and the fact that when you get to 13, you can't see them anymore, because I think the book's about that moment when our childhood ends, really, and we don't spend so much time daydreaming, lost in our imagination, and the peer group sort of kicks in and you start to join the adult world and reality. So that's really why I use the idea of the Lost Property Office and being lost and found, because that's the sort of theme of the whole book, I suppose.
Yes, it's a real transition period for many children, leaving the security of being a little child and becoming a teenager. And where better to set it than on the Underground, which is labyrinthine and confusing and the start and terminus of so many people's journeys. I believe that this story was actually inspired by seeing a mouse at Highbury and Islington Tube Station.
Yeah, absolutely, because I actually live out at Palmer's Green now, so the best way to get to us is to get the Overground, which is the Moorgate line, but it starts underground, and these quite big trains start at Moorgate and then they don't come up until Drayton Park. So at Highbury and Islington, you come off the Victoria line and you connect with the Overground, but it's an underground station. But because it's an overground train, you often have to wait 15 minutes, sometimes 30 minutes if you're not lucky. So I've spent hours of my time sitting on a bench on that dusty old platform, and I started to notice this family of fabulously gritty, grubby mice who sort of whir around, you know, like those kind of wind-up mice, you know, dragging bits of broken crisp and crusts of old sandwiches to a hidey hole. And then as soon as the big train blew in, you know, that kind of wind that comes in through the tunnels, they'd scuttle off, disappear completely into the walls. And I think it made me think about what it would be like to have a parallel world down there, that other creatures who live from foraging and stuff that goes on in those tunnels. So yes, I love it too. I'm glad you like it, because I love some of the architecture. I love the hidden London side of things, you know, the secret places.
And as you say, those ghost tube stations that we rattle through almost without noticing, and you just wonder what is going on in those places that haven't been touched since the 1940s.
That's right. Exactly. Absolutely. And all the strange sounds down there. And already with a group of children, we've talked about the underground. I went to a school actually in Oxfordshire because I thought I need to make sure that this book isn't so London centred, that it's not going to appeal to anyone outside London. But I think it really did, because I think that sort of network of tunnels, and a lot of children have passed through London. And we were sort of discussing words, and it was all like smelly and dark and dusty and grimy. But that's all part of it, isn't it? It's all part of what makes it so special. And I think the London Underground being built when it was, the tunnels are so tiny, because if you go to other cities, there's much more space around you. But it's that fact that you're in a sort of burrow down there that makes it quite particular.
Now, the Flits themselves have a very specific diet that they ask Edie to help them satisfy. And they rather reminded me of the borrowers, little people who have to rely on their bigger human neighbours for provisions.
Absolutely. I mean, I love the borrowers. And of course, there's a huge influence there. Very much so. But it was sort of updating it to the modern world. So there's a big scene when Nid, who's one of the Flits and very sort of acrobatic, is determined to upend a huge box of Rice Krispies so that he can fulfill his desire and eat all these Rice Krispies. So he does a very complex series of manoeuvres involving the sugar spoon and jumping off a bowl and pushing the entire box of cereal onto the floor so that he can scoop it all up. But yes, they do. And they love things like those sugar sprinkles, you know, the coloured sprinkles, and Marmite. It's a very modern day diet, but one that would appeal to little people, definitely.
And the audiobook version has been brought wonderfully to life by Charlie Sanderson, who I think was just born to read this kind of book. And I know it was very important to you that it should be an audio book as well as the beautifully illustrated paperback copy that is also available.
That's right. Yeah, audiobooks are a bit in my DNA because I spent about 15 years working for the BBC as a radio producer and then went freelance. And now, because of the amazing boom in audiobooks, I spend a lot of time producing audiobooks. Not so many for children, sadly. I wish I could. So I do have a particular interest in them. And I think Charlie Sanderson's such a good reader, mainly because she doesn't fall into that trap. I think it's quite easy with people coming to children's books to immediately sort of put on a very high-pitched voice and and it's all a bit sort of ditzy and it just doesn't quite work. Whereas I think what's great about her, she has a very lovely voice and she's absolutely got that thing of keeping a very steady narration and then just breaking into the voices when you need them and doesn't over-dramatise it too much, which is always a danger, I think, with audiobooks. But she also makes the children wise and sensible and, yes, a bit crazy if it needs to be, but never making them silly or ditzy. And that's what's so good about her, I think. So I'm delighted.
The screeches and squawks of a dozen birds bounced off the walls of the tunnel. Just out of reach of their sharp, nipping beaks, the family hurtled along in a ragged line, trying to escape. "Faster," said the oldest boy at the front, his head no bigger than a matchstick, and his wings whirring like a tiny windmill in a storm. Up ahead, the tunnel divided into two. "Take the left turn," shouted his sister from just behind him. They shot to the left and disappeared round a bend. Within seconds, the screeches began to fade. It was clear that their pursuers had gone the other way.
"Let's stop," gasped the youngest. "Just for a minute."
They landed on an electricity junction box just beside the train tracks. The youngest did a quick head count.
"Where's Flum?"
he said, his voice suddenly panicky. Only minutes before she had been there, flying behind them.
"Flum!"
he called back into the tunnel. There was silence. Flum had disappeared.
Charlie Sanderson narrating Edie and the Box of Flits, written by my guest, Kate Wilkinson.
Now, one thing that fans of the audiobook will not see are the beautiful illustrations by Joe Berger. Can you just describe those to us?
Absolutely. Well, I knew that although he's based in Bristol now, he'd lived for quite a long time in London. And so the interior, it's a chapter book with quite a lot of illustrations through it and some full page or half page. And they're black and white, but he's done some brilliant ones of down in the tunnels where the three children are going through with by torchlight. And he's just got the detail absolutely right. And there's a scene at the Wilderness Station, which is over Highgate Tube, with a sort of overgrown, tangled platform. And again, he's got all that beautifully. I hope if TFL see it, they'd be pleased. He's really good. They're sort of cartoony, but in a very good way, a sort of very strong way, and I think a way that's going to really appeal. And the cover is a lovely kind of bluey green. It has Edie in the middle of it, sort of filled with surprise, looking at a box which has opened up and one of the flits has come out of it. And then perched on the writing, Edie in the Box of Flits, is Shadwell, who is Vera Creech's right-hand crow, a London crow called Shadwell, because he was found in Shadwell. And then all around the edges, Joe's put these lovely bits of the gold valuables, jewellery that's going missing, but also the stuff that the flits forage. So a ring pull on a can and a bottle top and a thimble full of sprinkles and things like that. So it's a lovely mixture of foraging and the jewellery heist, the stealing that goes on that Edie has to solve.
I know that apart from being a radio producer, you have also done some work for the RNIB in the past.
Absolutely, Red. I did. I mean, it was about 20 years ago now when the RNIB's magazine programme, and there was a producer on that called Kim Normanton, and I often helped her out with features and occasionally would produce it as well. So I have very good memories of the fantastic studios down in Camden, which were a lot nicer than the BBC ones, I have to say. And it was always a really interesting magazine to put together and interesting items. So yes, I didn't actually produce that many, but I always enjoyed the ones I did, and I helped out with Kim quite often doing pieces that she'd commissioned me to do, as I'd just gone freelance actually. So it was a great one to do.
Well, hopefully you are already working on the sequel to Edie and the Box of Flits, and I can invite you back to talk about it, and we might actually meet in the Camden studios.
That would be so great, Red. I'd really enjoy that. And the sequel's actually meant to be set on the Paris Metro, but whether I'll ever get there to research it, I don't know. But it would be very nice to chat again. Yes, please.
Well, Kate Wilkinson, thank you so much for introducing us to Edie and the Box of Flits. It's a wonderful story about friendship, family, and noticing the little things in life.
Yes, I hope so. I hope your listeners enjoy it. I really do. And thank you for having me on.
Edie and the Box of Flits is out now in print, ebook, and audio. And Kate will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, we go from rags to riches with Sarah Moore Fitzgerald. But first, it was perhaps the hottest debut of last year. Fireboy by J.M. Joseph introduced middle-grade readers to combustible superhero Aidan Sweeney. And now Aidan is back in a smouldering sequel, Pants on Fire. Here's J.M. Joseph to tell us more.
Jay, welcome back to Read On.
Oh, well, thanks for having me back. It's great to be here.
So Aidan has just about come to terms with his new superpower and can almost control its effects on his wardrobe, but he's got a whole host of other problems to deal with in Pants on Fire.
Absolutely. The second book in the series takes up his adventures about 6 weeks later. And when it starts off, the circus tour is coming to an end. So what happens next? Does Aidan, 12-year-old, does he become a permanent circus star, or does he go back to school? Well, his mom is pretty sure what she wants. He wants him back in school. But then suddenly things take a big change when an American shows up by the name of Delilah Jones, and she's willing to pay for an extravaganza circus. She wants to bring him to Central Park in New York to cheer up her grandfather, one of the richest men in the world, Clayton Jones. And that's when the adventures take off.
And that's when the alarm bells should start ringing.
Absolutely. Rich men don't do favors, do they? But I very much enjoyed this part of it. To be honest, the whole idea from it came from my agent, because they were like, well, you know, this is a traveling circus and you're American, take them back to New York. And so that's what we did. And it was a lot of fun, actually. So the first part of it, they're still in London. And the second part, they moved to Central Park and it's set in America. And you've got some great characters there and a lot of fun. The same sort of laughs and misadventures and miscues, but with some very new characters in this book.
And it's also complicated by the fact that Aidan's two best friends, Sadie and Hussein, are not speaking to each other.
Yes, well, it takes a while. You know, what happens is Aidan has a friend at MI5 who tells the children that there's a villain out there by the name of Sloane Sixsmith. And she is after Aidan and his sweets, another sweets that give them these superpowers. So what MI5 can do is they convince Aidan's friends, Sadie and Hussein, and their parents to help them go along to New York to keep them company. And that's, you know, when you put three friends together, there's always going to be trouble. So that's the premise for it anyway. And that's how the adventures start.
And just in case anybody hasn't picked up Fireboy yet, these beans, these sweets, which were sent to them mysteriously through the post in the first book, unlock your inner superpower. So Sadie can move things by psychokinesis, and Hussein can make computers do his bidding. And Aidan, well, you tell us what happens with Aidan.
Well, Aidan is impulsive. He's a fiery little character, so he just bursts into flames. And it's not always easy to control, but by book two, he's getting much, much better at it. And that's the whole premise for it, too. And everyone wants these. And in fact, not only do Aidan and Sadie Hussein can change, but also his cat Lemon, who can transform into a tiger, which is always a lot of fun, I think.
Yes, just when you think things can't get any more bizarre.
Lemon. Who wouldn't want a tiger for a pet? I mean, particularly when it can change back and forth to a cat.
Seemingly it will.
Seemingly it will, yes. Well, they do try and teach it to help things along. Otherwise, it could get quite complicated.
There is also a very nosy investigative journalist wanting to get to the source of the beans.
Yes. Well, one of the things I wanted to do for Pants on Fire, much like Fireboy, was to get a lot of newspapers and broadcasts and lists and things like that involved. So there are newspapers who are trying to out who is this Fireboy? How can he do this? So there's that sort of side to it as well. Because I quite like writing fun newspaper accounts as well and funny headlines. So they're a big part of the book, too.
And it also feeds into that no gift comes without complications type of message that came through in the original book. With a gift comes a responsibility for managing it.
Absolutely. I didn't go all kind of Marvel with it straight off. I mean, Marvel Comics, I grew up reading them. I grew up reading Spider-Man and the Avengers and the X-Men and all the rest of them. They were a big inspiration for Fireboy and Pants on Fire when I did it, because I just loved them. I thought they were fun. When I thought about trying to write for children, I wanted to write a novel based around those things, and not so much the big fight scenes, but kind of more about the characters. That's what always interested me. And you know, what Batman beating a Joker, beating him up didn't bother me, but I was more interested about what he did in the Batcave. You know, what happened down there? Those are the things that I liked. And so that's what Fireboy and Pants on Fire is about. But yeah, just as you say, you have to look out for each other. There's community. Friendship is a huge part of it. And hopefully that comes through.
I suppose superheroes are our modern take on ancient mythology that, say, the Greeks or the Romans had, that whereas they were immortal beings who just appeared in human form, we've created superheroes who tend to be humans who have acquired a superpower and find it quite difficult to manage.
Absolutely. Well, I think the emphasis really isn't so much on super or even myth, but mostly hero. So many of these great stories follow the old hero's journey, the old Joseph Campbell's part, where you have a hero who starts off sometimes a kind of special birth or normal boy or girl. They suddenly get a power to save their community. They have to go out on an adventure. They go on the adventure. The only way to become a hero, though, is they find a mentor, and somewhere along the line, they suffer. They have to be a hero. You can't just have everything go well for you. And you have to overcome these things. And that's, I think, in those stories, whether it's Greek heroes, whether it's Spider-Man or Aidan Sweeney, that's what it comes through. I was really struck by it in recent events with Marcus Rashford and Jadon Sancho and Bukayo Saka, because here you have these talented, if you like, superheroes, young men who can do incredible things with a football. And they're out to help their community, and they stumble, they lose. But we, you know, we watching this, we know they're heroes, don't we? We know how this story, we're hoping, we can see now this huge outpouring of affection for the three of them is obviously related to the abuse they suffered, but also because we see the story. We know how this is going to end, and we want them to succeed now, because that's what heroes do.
That's an incredibly important lesson for your target audience of middle grade years, years 6, 7, 8, to learn. Up to that stage, when you're a small child, you can actually live quite a sheltered life. And yet, as you are coming up to your teenage years, you realize that life is more complicated. And just because you want something doesn't always mean that you're going to be able to achieve it.
Absolutely. I mean, when Joseph Campbell, when he wrote A Hero of a Thousand Faces, the idea of the hero's journey is that we are the heroes. Each one is a hero of his or her own life. Just like that, we will have losses. We will make mistakes. But the idea is to grow from it, to carry on. Somewhere along our lives, we would have had a mentor. Somewhere along our lives, we would have been betrayed. But what we must do is try and overcome this. And I think that's what children, that's what they see in these stories in many respects. And it's obviously a bit of wish fulfillment to think, wow, wouldn't it be great to fly? But it's just this idea of adventure. It's why heroes still speak to us.
And the setbacks actually make the achievements greater. And that message of resilience has never been more important than over the last 18 months. And it's something that you, as a school teacher, must have faced pretty much every day.
I think it was one of the biggest changes I've saw this year over the last 18 months. When the first lockdown came last summer, and we went back to teaching online. It was a little fun. It was a bit novice. We were all kind of getting used to it. A lot of mistakes were made. Well, maybe fun might be a bit of an exaggeration, but we all felt that there was an end in sight. And so we persevered with it. And then the summer came and school broke up and great. This time around, though, near Easter and before Christmas, when we went back to lockdown again, you could see that the older the children I teach, 10 to 13 year olds, the older they got, the more difficult they found it. And they began to worry, you know, when will this end? Because I think we mentioned about suffering and heroes. Well, yeah, I think everyone can do it as long as they know there's an end in sight. And that's been the difficult thing for young people. Where is this end? And for young boys and girls, men and women who live in the moment, a week seems a long time. So it has been very difficult. And we found as teachers, instead of maybe focusing on a curriculum, what you became more interested in is simply the individuals, what your objectives were about just emotional well-being, giving them opportunities to chat with their friends, giving them as many creative individual tasks to set themselves as best you can. And hopefully we can learn from that and make a curriculum that is more, if you like, focused on children's needs moving forward.
And in that, the escapism of reading is central.
Absolutely. I mean, I ought to make it clear. I mean, my books are made, they laugh. I mean, there's a little bit of suffering in there, but it's pure escapism. I'm coming over all serious, but there's nothing serious about my books. They're just, they're funny. I like to think there's an undertone there, but trust me, it is more about kids blowing smoke out of their bottom and those sorts of things, really, burning their clothes off and embarrassing themselves in public and all the things and situation comedies. But whatever gets you through tonight, yeah?
Sadie pointed to the llama stamp. This was posted in Peru. How curious. Are you going to open it or wait until your mum comes home? Waiting had never crossed my mind. My only worry was Granny. At any minute, the she-bear might stumble out of her bed cave. If she did, I could kiss this parcel goodbye. Granny would snatch it away, and what would I be left with? A stiff wallop over the head for daring to answer the door. I picked up the parcel. Trust me, Mum would want me to open it. Carefully, I tore around the stamps and postmarks, those I wanted to keep. The rest I ripped apart. Underneath the brown paper was a cocoon of tape. There was no way I could unravel that. Do you have any scissors? No. Sadie said, though this might be useful. She undid her satchel and pulled out a small bundle of cloth, unknotting it to reveal an arrowhead with a tip as sharp as an eagle's talon. Mummy got it for me in America. What do you think? Think? I stared into her satchel. I think you Lady Pandora's girls know how to pack a school bag.
And I believe that the new book is also being brought to life as an audiobook by Neil Gardner.
I hope so, because I think Neil is absolutely brilliant, and the Fireboy Audible still makes me laugh. It was great to hear my words in his voice, the way they should be said, not through my sort of dulcet tones.
And as we discussed last time, I know that making books accessible is very close to your heart because of your own family connection to sight loss.
Yes, and certainly having stories which sound good, stories which are dialogue driven, that have a pacey plots. These are the things that can kind of keep us reading informed. My most experience, of course, my grandmother had glaucoma, and that made a big impression on me as a child. And I can still remember reading to her from the newspaper. For me, on my end, a lot of my experience would be children who have difficulties reading and not so much seeing as well. And so you want to make stories which are accessible to them. And hopefully Fireboy and Pants and Fire both are.
And they will keep them laughing throughout the summer holidays. J.M. Joseph, thank you so much for coming back on to Read On and sharing the continuing adventures of Aidan Sweeney. I assume you're working on the third book already.
I am indeed very much. Trying to sweat it out, basically, here in my little room here in Bristol.
Well, I hope you come back and tell us about the third book. But in the meantime, thanks for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
Both Fireboy and Pants on Fire are out now commercially in print and ebook, with that audiobook version of Pants on Fire on its way soon. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Kate Wilkinson to share the books of her life, one day you're broke, the next you have all the money in the world. But can it buy you happiness? This is the question that Sarah Moore Fitzgerald asks in her latest novel for children. She joined me from her home in Ireland to tell me more. Sarah Moore Fitzgerald, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
The book is very much about two different worlds living side by side and separated by the chances that money gives you.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's a rags to riches story, I suppose you could call it. And it really explores the nature of disadvantage in the main character. You know, all of those hundreds of moments of difficulty and struggle that might be invisible to people who don't experience disadvantage, but are very real to the characters and particularly to the main character in this book. So when we first meet her, she's really struggling. She's worried about her mum all the time, who's also struggling. Money worries are never far away. It's kind of like they're hanging on by their fingernails. And any little mishap that happens, it feels more like a disaster to them because, you know, they have damp in their flat that can't be fixed, or when her mum's car breaks down, or when she needs something for school, everything is a big mountain to climb for her. And it sort of dominates a lot of her experiences early in the book and makes us understand where her longing comes from when she sees a glimpse of another world, which is more glamorous and more comfortable and more exciting than anything she's ever had in her life.
And your protagonist, Penny, she's 15 years old and she lives in a building that's been converted into tenement flats. And exactly the same building, the twin building, is just across from her, and it's still lived in by one old woman. And the people who live in the flats are very suspicious of this woman. She's a recluse. They think she's a bit of a witch. And yet it turns out that she's really just very lonely and misunderstood.
I mean, that's exactly it. And I think as the story unfolded, as I was writing it, Violet became a really important kind of foundation stone of the story. So just as you say, right at the beginning, nobody has seen Violet Fitzsimons. None of the children from the flats or anyone from the flats has seen her. And all these kind of awful stories have been built up around the myth of Violet Fitzsimons. People think she's a monster or a witch. They say awful things like she's got man traps in her garden so that if anyone had the audacity to climb over the wall and into the garden, they would be caught and then thrown into this dungeon that everyone believes is in the basement of Violet Fitzsimons' pristine, old, perfectly preserved house. And in that way that sometimes does happen, Violet has become stereotyped and she's greatly feared. And it's only a kind of a chance encounter with Violet that Penny begins to realize that all the stories that she has been told and all the reasons she's been frightened of Violet are all just untrue. And she discovers that Violet is a really wonderful person with all sorts of interesting, colorful stories and talents. And the beginning of that friendship also marks the opening of a door to Penny of opportunities that she could never have imagined before she met Violet.
Yes, Violet is the key to hopefully unlock some of Penny's dreams. And the book is very much divided into two halves. Impoverished Penny, who has a very rich life in the community of the flats that she lives in, has a miserable life at school. And as you say, there are money worries. The living conditions make her clothes smell, which means that really the teachers write her off as somebody who's never going to achieve anything. And yet, when Violet makes her a gift of €1 million, it projects her into the school that she's always dreamed of going to, and that brings about its own problems.
Completely. It's a real study of be careful what you wish for, because when Penny's dreams come true, which Violet enables, a whole new set of problems emerge. And Penny faces an awful lot of internal turmoil and struggle about her own identity and about how she's going to integrate herself into this school. And there's so much conflict and struggle in her own head about who she is and how she presents herself and what she reveals and conceals about herself when she goes to the Pearlbourne Academy, full of really privileged girls who have lives that she could never have imagined. So, yeah, it's very much a book of two halves, with all of the longing in the first half and then the sudden dream coming true and the opportunities and challenges that that brings. So it's not all plain sailing. An awful lot of the drama of the story happens after she gets this amazing prize and this fund and this opportunity.
Yes, absolutely. All the money in the world can buy you a lot of opportunity, but is it really going to buy you happiness?
Exactly. There's the question. And, you know, Red, I didn't want to be too pious or simplistic about it because I wanted the story to recognize that money makes a massive difference to people's lives. And for a child who's been so deprived, the arrival of this great sum of money, you know, gives her so many gifts and enables so many things. But because she doesn't feel good about her own self inside, the lesson is that it doesn't really matter how rich you are if you don't have that sense of self-worth that's much more important. And that the whole idea that what penny is worth is not about money, that she has all sorts of other riches that she's always had. And that's kind of a lesson that she has to learn throughout the story.
Yes, without giving any spoilers, the constant in this story is kindness and friendship. And if Penny can hold on to that throughout the story, then you get the sense that she will always feel comfortable in her own skin, despite the distractions of money or the privations of poverty.
Oh, Red, I wish I could have written that down. That's exactly it. That's the complete summary of the kind of spirit and purpose and the beating heart of this story. You've summarized it just beautifully there.
Now, whilst the book asks quite a lot of hard questions, there's also quite a lot of fun in it as well. And I know that you are a professor of psychology and especially the psychology of pedagogy, of teaching. And I'm often struck by how miserable some of the books aimed at mid-teen years can be. And yet you managed to keep a joy in your writing as well.
Oh, I'm so glad that you feel that, Red, because, yeah, I suppose as a writer and as a teacher, I think that one of the most important access points to engagement and to understanding and to insight and to wisdom is fun. You know, that if you're doing something that you enjoy, then you're going to be learning things without even realizing it. It's not going to feel like a hard slog. I see that in college all the time and when I teach, that when you design activities, even if they're challenging, they'll have a huge sense of fun and celebration and sometimes even ridiculousness about them. That it just becomes this joyful thing, that the development of your skills or of your abilities just becomes a kind of a natural part of the process. And I really believe that should be the case in storytelling as well. I mean, there's no point in writing a story that's a thinly veiled lecture or moralistic, pious lesson for life. I think that the most important thing about a novel is that it just should be a really good story, a really fun thing to read, and that everything else will follow from that. So my main aim when I set out to write a story and to construct it in a way that I think will work is to make sure that it's just loads of fun. And I'm so glad that you say that, because while there's poverty and there's anxiety and there's stress and other themes of privilege and class in this story, they really are kind of almost byproducts. And what I hope more than anything is that this is just a cracking good story that people will enjoy reading.
And I know that you're also passionate about stories being made accessible to all readers. And I understand that an audiobook version of All the Money in the World is being recorded as we speak. But in the meantime, you very kindly offered to read a passage from the book.
I'd love to do that, Red, for the moment. So let me just give you a little bit of context. So it's a little bit of a way into the story. And Penny has already got to know Violet, and she's discovered that Violet is not the monster that everybody has imagined that she is. And one of the wonderful things she's discovered about Violet is that Violet is a wonderful pianist and a beautiful musician. And kind of long story short, Violet suggests that she should teach Penny how to play the piano. And Penny has started to get lessons every Thursday from her. But one day she arrives for her lesson and she's had a really, really bad day at school. And like all teachers, like all good teachers, Violet takes one look at her and says, you know, I don't think she's able for a class today. I think that we should do something a little bit different. So she decides that Penny is going to sit and listen and that she's going to play music for her. So here we go. This is Violet at first. I don't think we'll have a normal lesson today, Penny. I rather think you may not be feeling up to it. What if I play for you? Let me see. How about Mozart? No, no, we've had him the last 2 weeks. A little Chopin? No, rather too fiendish for today's purposes. She looked up at the ceiling. Let me think. For similar reasons, let's not go near Debussy or Tchaikovsky. Her grey eyes twinkled. Aha, she said it so loudly, it made me flinch a little on the stool. I know the very thing. Beethoven Sonata Number 8. I told her I didn't know this music. And she said, well, then not a single moment of your life must elapse. So come on now, up off the stool, make yourself comfortable here, pour yourself some tea and do have a biscuit. Today, I shall do the rest. She took her place on the piano stool and was silent for an awkwardly long time. And the sun shone through the bay window, landing on her like a spotlight. If you've ever heard Beethoven's Sonata Number 8, then I don't have to describe it. And if you haven't heard it, then I can't explain. But it's as if someone wise has begun to tell you a story that has no words, only feelings and great understanding. And when it speeds up, it's like 100 people dancing, and layers of different themes and threads and notes make you weighted to the ground. You can't move when this music is playing. It makes statues of us all. The dance happens inside you, in a deeper part of you. Allegro di molto e con brio, shouted Violet over the music, and I was jolted out of my stillness for a second, practically knocking the tea tray off its table. Movement nearly over, she shouted again, and finished with a glorious bam, 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 and was still. Then she whispered, second movement, as if there was something coming and I needed to be especially prepared for it. Adagio cantabile. Here it comes. She bent her head like someone saying a prayer and held her fingers over the keyboard. And I will never forget where I was and how it felt and how the air landed on my skin the first time I heard it. Sonata Number 8, Movement Number 2. Adagio cantabile means slowly, song-like, designed to imitate the human voice in music. But as far as I was concerned, the music imitated nothing but itself. All the sadness, all the beauty, all the longing, all the regret, all the hope, all the love, all the dreams, all the goodness, all the peace swirling around in the room. It felt to me like Violet's playing was pulling the music out of the walls of her house, bringing an ancient and glorious thing into the space. A thing that had always been there waiting, but could only be brought to life by the touch of her elegant fingers on the silky keys. In everyone's life, there is a moment, a first. This was mine. And whenever I face anything dark or difficult, I will forever bring myself back to it. The soft chair in Violet Fitzsimons's huge piano room and the smell of the strong tea and the sunshine spilling in on top of us and her elegant grace and the sonata. Like colours I had never seen, rising in clouds from the beetle-black piano, a rainbow of perfect sound.
My guest, Sarah Moore Fitzgerald, reading from her latest novel, All the Money in the World. And a wonderful reminder there, Sarah, of the power of good teaching to fling open rooms in your mind that will stay open and occupied for the rest of your life.
Oh, well, exactly. You know, I suppose Violet is sort of my archetype of the perfect teacher who really pays attention to Penny and really listens to her and really knows on a kind of almost moment to moment basis what she needs most and how Violet can fill that gap, you know. So, yeah, it really is. It's about particularly that scene. I think it's the power of connection, you know, with all of the know-how there is in teaching all over the world. It's the nature of the relationship that the teacher establishes with the student that should be at the center of it. And that's what matters most. And I suppose that scene tries to show that.
And another way that we open our minds is obviously through reading. And I wonder if there was a book that you read as a youth that made you fall in love with storytelling or want to become an author.
Oh, Red, there are so many. But I suppose one of the ones that I come back to again and again is a book that I read when I was probably about 12 or 13. And that is Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca. While I was a reader much younger than that, there was something about my memory of reading that book, how breathless I was, and this incredible twist that literally made me fall out of bed as I was reading it, and it brought me to my knees, that just made me so captivated about the power of what a good story can do and how stories can reach beyond time and space and kind of hit you between the eyes. So Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier is one of my all-time favorite books. And I go back to it again and again, just as a kind of a masterclass in brilliant storytelling, I think, more than anything.
And do I sense a little bit of an echo of Mandalay in the house in which Violet lives in All the Money in the World?
Oh, for goodness sake, you're so perceptive. I think there are so many things about your, you know, when you're a writer, your favorite stories are kind of imprinted on you. So they sort of leak out in your own storytelling, sometimes subconsciously, because it was only when I got to the end of writing All the Money in the World that I realized that there was a footprint of du Maurier in there. And I'm delighted you recognized it too.
Sarah Moore Fitzgerald, thank you so much for taking us further into the world of All the Money in the World. I shall thoroughly look forward to the audiobook version. And thank you very much for coming on to the show and being a guest.
Oh, it's just been so lovely talking to you. Thank you so much, Red. Absolute pleasure.
All the Money in the World is out now in print and ebook, with an audio version on its way soon. Now it's back to Kate Wilkinson for the books of her life.
So Kate, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Well, I wondered, Red, if I could slightly stretch the boundaries of this a bit. This is actually an audiobook, and it was very significant with my two boys when they were youngsters. Am I allowed to bring that in?
It is the audiobook show, so yes, I think so. That's fine.
Oh, thank you so much. I know I would have absolutely loved it as a child. I really would. And when I was a child, audiobooks weren't quite of the quality they are now. And this particular book, it's the Graveyard Book by Neil Gaiman. And I just never forget, we had a long car journey and we put it on. And my boys were quite young and they were very open to audio, actually. We had weeks and weeks of listening to Stephen Fry with Harry Potter. I felt like it was never going to end, but it was very good. But anyway, I put this on and they were utterly transfixed. I think Neil Gaiman, for me, is probably the best audiobook reader I've ever heard. And the Graveyard Book, it's a fabulous story. I mean, it's quite dark. It's about Nobody Owens, who's known to his friends as Bod. And he's a perfectly normal boy, but he wouldn't actually be perfectly normal if he didn't live in a graveyard. And he's raised and educated by ghosts. So that's the premise for the story. And it's just marvellous, Red. It's just brilliant. And I can still hear his voice reading. So, you know, there's quite a lot of menace in it, but there's also so much warmth and humanity and his friendship amongst these ghouls and ghosts in the graveyard and how much care they take of him. And my boys also, we talk about it sometimes, and it was very formative to them. So I hope you accept that as a formative one.
The man Jack sniffed the air. He ignored the scents that had come into the room with him, dismissed the scents that he could safely ignore, honed in on the smell of the thing he had come to find. He could smell the child, a milky smell, like chocolate chip cookies, and the sour tang of a wet, disposable nighttime diaper. He could smell the baby shampoo in its hair, and something small and rubbery. A toy, he thought, then no, something to suck, that the child had been carrying. The child had been here. It was here no longer. The man Jack followed his nose down the stairs, through the middle of the tall, thin house. He inspected the bathroom, the kitchen, the airing cupboard, and finally the downstairs hall, in which there was nothing to be seen but the family's bicycles, a pile of empty shopping bags, a fallen diaper, and the stray tendrils of fog that had insinuated themselves into the hall from the open door to the street. The man Jack made a small noise then, a grunt that contained in it both frustration and also satisfaction. He slipped the knife into its sheath in the inside pocket of his long coat, and he stepped out into the street. There was moonlight, and there were streetlights, but the fog stifled everything, muted light and muffled sound, and made the night shadowy and treacherous. He looked down the hill towards the light of the closed shops, then up the street, where the last high houses wound up the hill on their way to the darkness of the old graveyard.
Neil Gaiman narrating his novel The Graveyard Book, which is available commercially. An alternative version read by Geoffrey Drew is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I've actually chosen a non-fiction one for this. I read and read. I love so much fiction and do go back to books. But on a rainy day, there's actually a book. It's called Wild Swim, and it's by Kate Rue, and she's gathered together lots of wonderful places. I know wild swimming is really taking off now, and there's so many books about it, but I think she was in there first. And it's just a beautiful book of lovely walks and places, secret places where you can go swimming, and she writes a couple of pages about each place. And I find it really joyful, particularly when I'm feeling a bit trapped in London, which does happen to me from time to time, because although I've spent most of my adult life here, I didn't grow up here. So I just look at the photos of people plunging in the fairy pools in Skye and imagine myself there and just enjoying her really vivid descriptions of nature and what it feels like to be at duck's eye level.
Unfortunately, Wild Swim by Kate Rue is only available commercially in print. But here's a YouTube clip of Kate talking about her love of wild swimming.
And I'd always swum, but in a kind of accidental way. You know, I might find myself breaking into a Lido at midnight or jumping into a lock when I was going for a walk, or being the one who didn't stay on board the canal boat for Pimm's, but, you know, took a little bit of a swim in the Thames. But there was something about my swimming that had changed, and it had become much more intentional, where I was beginning to go places purely to seek out a swim in the sort of same way that a surfer would seek out a break. 13 years ago, in 2006, I set up something called the Outdoor Swimming Society. Not entirely on purpose, it was a sort of excess of enthusiasm for swimming. What was 300 in that first year has grown now to 70,000 people following the Outdoor Swimming Society, but actually millions more going for a swim. But the problem of running an organisation that's basically a kind of cross between a cult and a pyramid-selling organisation is that, you know, I'd effectively brainwashed myself as well as everyone else, so I couldn't really stop. We had one message and one message only, which is, come on in, the water is lovely. So that was the Outdoor Swimming Society. So I was totally delighted to talk today about the discomfort of swimming. It's like, tell you the truth, you know, quit all this, the water's lovely. What's really going on out there is that it's cold and it's uncomfortable and it's sometimes terrifying.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
It's another non-fiction, although there's lots of wonderful stories in it. It's a book called Mudlarking by Lara Makelam. And it's a really wonderful book about the Thames. It's about mudlarking on the Thames, using old maps as guides to London's boatyards and quaysides and bridges, and all those places where rubbish was dumped. Lara Makelam scoured the foreshore of the Thames looking for pieces that would take us back in history. And the book really is a series of stories about the different things she found. So, for instance, she found the letters of a printing press. I think it was near Hammersmith. And she traced the story back to the history of the printers who were on the banks of the Thames and why all the different steel or cast iron arms with the letters on the end got thrown in the river. And it's just a treasure trove of brilliant stories. And she writes very, very well, too. So that is my recent book. And it's a joy. I would recommend anybody.
It is hot and airless on the 742 from Greenwich to Cannon Street. I am squeezed between strangers, straining to avoid the feel of unknown bodies. No one makes eye contact, and no one speaks. There is an unwritten rule of silence on the early morning London commute, and barely a murmur can be heard, just the rustle of newspapers and the high-pitched squeal of the rails as we lurch and sway towards the city. I know every inch of this route. For nearly 20 years it has taken me to the centre of London, for work, to meetings, to see friends, and to visit the river in search of treasure. I know when to hold tight, where the tracks jolt the train to one side, how long the gaps are between stops, and when the driver will start to slow down for the next station. For years I have watched old graffiti fade and new graffiti appear. For 6 months now I have been watching a sports sock, discarded and stuck to the tracks, turn from white to tattered, dirty brown. This journey will take me 17 minutes, and I am impatient. I check my watch again and work back 3 hours from today's predicted low tide. The river will be at its lowest at 10:23 a.m. My timing is perfect. I twitch and shift from foot to foot as the train pulls out of London Bridge Station, willing it to speed up. I am almost there. We trundle over a railway viaduct, past Southwark Cathedral with its dappled flint dressing and Gothic spires, and through the centre of Borough Market. I look out over its glazed roof and try to spot the cast-iron pineapples balanced above one of the entrances. Then the sky opens up and I am above the river on Cannon Street Bridge, water flowing towards me from the west and away from me to the east.
Laura Makelam, narrating her book, Mudlarking, Lost and Found on the River Thames, which is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Well, Kate Wilkinson, thank you so much for sharing your joy of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show today.
It was an absolute pleasure, Red. Thank you so much for asking me on.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can listen to us anytime by subscribing to your favourite podcast provider. Simply search for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sale, which is REDSZELL, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to all my guests, to producer Hannah, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.